Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 508, titled The Vatican Rag, Part 2, Der Panzerkardinal. This has been recorded on April 24th of the year 2005. Where this is a supplement to For the Record Program Number 504, The Vatican Rag, Part 1, and we're going to take a look at the history and resume, I guess you could say, of Pope Benedict XVI. Nay, Joseph Ratzinger, nicknamed Der Panzerkardinal for reasons that we will discuss. By way of highlighting not only the origins of the nickname Der Panzerkardinal, but also the very, very close working relationship that this pope had with the last pope, we're going to turn to an article from United Press International of April 3rd of 2005. This article is called Analysis, Ratzinger in the Ascendance. It's by Uwe Simon Netto, UPI Religious Affairs Editor. And skipping down, we read of the relationship between J.P. II and Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, Der Panzerkardinal. We read, the Pole and the German have been called intellectual bedfellows. For almost 20 years, the two met at least once a week, usually Fridays, for a 90-minute discussion of doctrine and discipline. A working lunch followed, lasting often until late in the afternoon. A theological liberal of sorts in his youth, Ratzinger was later nicknamed the Panzerkardinal for his iron hand in bringing Marxist priests in Latin America and clerics with mushy views on sexual ethics to heel. His image as the Vatican's enforcer stands in stark contrast with Ratzinger, the gentle intellectual and pianist Germans have come to admire when he was a professor of fundamental theology and later Archbishop of Munich and Freising. Well, the nickname Panzerkardinal, from which this broadcast derives its partial title, not only referred to the iron hand that Ratzinger used in crushing dissidents within the church and liberation theologians in particular, it is also not only a reference to his German past, but also Ratzinger served in the Hitler Youth as a young man and then was drafted into an anti-aircraft unit that guarded a BMW plant that used slave laborers from the Dachau concentration camp. Due to limitations of time, I'm not going to discuss the specifics of his service in the Hitler Youth. It was during a time when service in the Hitler Youth was required. I will put that in the description for the broadcast when that is up on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Suffice it to say that there has been ample discussion of this in the media, and the spin that's been put on his participation in the Hitler Youth and his service in the Wehrmacht was that this taught him the dangers of totalitarianism and that Ratzinger was himself anti-Nazi. As we're going to see during the course of this broadcast, there is reason to suspect that that is not in fact the case. In fact, there is reason to suspect that Ratzinger is among that Vatican clique that was complicit with the post-war continuation of fascism and in particular with the recrudescence of Nazi finances and the escape, the diaspora of Nazi war criminals that took place after World War II. Now, by way of addressing the claims that Ratzinger was anti-Nazi and that his service in the Hitler Youth and the Wehrmacht taught him to hate fascism, etc., we're going to jump back in time to early 1944 and an anti-fascist classic that has been eclipsed over the course of time talked about the Nazis' plans to give an anti-Nazi resume, basically an anti-Nazi curriculum vitae, to everyone whom the Nazis had tabbed for post-war underground work. This classic, which we're going to excerpt right now, is called The Nazis Go Underground, authored by Kurt Riess, a brilliant anti-fascist writer whose work has been eclipsed with time. Riess, by the way, R-I-E-S-S. This was published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company in New York, 1944. And of the Nazis' plans to give an anti-Nazi resume to everyone whom they plan to use for post-war work, we read the following. This sort of thing has been going on for a long time. Several intelligence services have commented on the sudden disappearance of important personalities from political and party life. And it has become quite the accepted thing to everybody in Germany. But what has not yet become known is that all this also applies to a much greater number of anonymous persons all over Germany those on the second and third levels of the Nazi strata. These unknown personalities may be used later by the underground. Party functionaries who may be known locally, but certainly not nationally, can be easily transferred to another city or town, where they will suddenly appear as anti-Nazis. The party helps in their masquerades. These men get new documents which prove, unquote, that they have always been anti-Nazi. Notes are inserted in their personal file saying they must be watched on account of their anti-Hitler attitudes and, quote, unworthy, unquote, behavior. Some of them will undoubtedly be sent to concentration camps for crimes they have never committed, but which will make them look dependable in the eyes of the Allies. Some have perhaps already succeeded in joining anti-Nazi circles and are pretending to conspire against Hitler. Later on, they will be able to use such activities as alibis. There is discussion in the Nazis Go Underground of the training of youth who would serve in this capacity, and also the fact that police would be a particularly likely repository for this type of underground Nazi portrayed as an anti-Nazi. And indeed, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ratzinger's father was a policeman and allegedly anti-Nazi. Arnold Schwarzenegger's father was not anti-Nazi at all. He was a Class 3 war criminal, but Ratzinger's father was allegedly anti-Nazi. Still more from the Nazis Go Underground on the Third Reich's plans at giving an anti-Nazi resume to those whom they had selected for post-war work. Among the, quote, peaceful collaborators, unquote, the most prominent group numerically would be formed from those who, to all outward appearances, were never Nazis at heart, but who had to go along with the party for reasons of bread and butter, or because otherwise they might have been thrown into concentration camps. That is precisely the spin that has been put on Joseph Ratzinger. What we're going to take a look at next is Ratzinger's association with people, basically, the people who figured prominently in Ratzinger's rise through the Vatican hierarchy. Now, what we're going to do is to reprise a section of For the Record program number 504, The Vatican Rag Part 1, and we're going to take a look specifically at not only the genesis of fascism's association with the Vatican, but specifically, we're going to take a look at how the use of the Vatican Bank and Vatican finances was put to work not only by elements of Western intelligence that wanted to use the Nazis in the post-war period, people like Alan Dulles, but we're going to take a look also at how the cast of characters, whom we're going to be looking at later, coalesced in the World War II and post-World War II periods. Now, key names here for the subsequent discussion. First of all, Pope Paul VI, nay Giovanni Battista Montini, the Vatican Secretary of State, who was the principal figure involved in setting up the rat lines. That is the nickname that was applied to the Vatican escape route through which many of the top Nazi war criminals escaped. Some of them headed to Latin America, some of them to the U.S. and to service with U.S. intelligence in the post-war period, part of the genesis of the Fifth Column, which is now eroding this country. In addition to Pope Paul VI, nay Giovanni Battista Montini, also pay attention to Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi. Both were members of the crypto-fascist P2 Lodge. Both were Vatican advisors. Both were murdered. Michele Sindona was extradited from the U.S. to Italy, where he was going to stand trial for numerous crimes in Italy. He died of cyanide poisoning in prison. His successor, Roberto Calvi, was an alleged suicide, found hanged under Blackfriars Bridge. And by the way, Calvi also a P2 member. Roberto Calvi now, it has been disclosed, was actually murdered. Many suspected that all along. And in fact, the very day that Ratzinger was made Pope, the LA Times announced that four men have been indicted for Roberto Calvi's murder. So again, the key names here for subsequent purposes: Pope Paul VI, nay Giovanni Battista Montini, Michele Sindona, and Roberto Calvi. Here's an excerpt from For the Record 504. You will recall that this current recent pope, actually the most recently deceased pope, is called Pope John Paul II. He was named after Pope John Paul I, who lasted all of 28 days and then died under very strange circumstances. The available evidence suggests very, very strongly that Pope John Paul I was murdered. And the reason for that was that he was going to turn out the P2 Nexus, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, and the people that had been brought in by his predecessor, Pope Paul VI, nay, Giovanni Battista Montini, an individual who was active in helping to provide papers for many of the top Nazis to escape from Europe to Latin America and elsewhere after World War II. Unfortunately, John Paul I was not able to reform the Vatican. Indeed, his precipitous death after only 28 days in office was covered in RFA number 18. Among other broadcasts, the evidence suggests very strongly that he was murdered. For background on this broadcast, I recommend emphatically RFA program 17 through 21, available from Spitfire. We're going to take a look at, again, how the Vatican banking scandals, the P2 Lodge, the Nazi flight from Europe after World War II, the Nazi diaspora, and the reconstruction of the Nazi financial apparatus after World War II overlap not only with the Vatican, but specifically the circumstances that surrounded John Paul II. We're going to begin by reading a passage from The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and published in hardcover and softcover by the St. Martin's Press. The Hugh Angleton here is the father of James Jesus Angleton, for many years the CIA's counterintelligence chief, and Hugh Angleton was a doctrinaire fascist and an individual who bequeathed his legacy to the late James J. Angleton. Hugh Angleton's rise to power was in part an accident of geography. He lived in Milan for many years and made more than a few friends there before the war. It was Hugh Angleton who allegedly introduced Giovanni Battista Montini to Michele Sindona, a pre-war banker in Milan. Sindona was the corrupt financier who later became the advisor to the Vatican Bank. Montini, who was Vatican Undersecretary of State during the war, later became Pope Paul VI. Parenthetically, Sindona was a member of the P2, as was his successor, Roberto Calvi. Both died under very strange circumstances, and again, that's discussed in RFA program 17 through 21. Continuing, there is some circumstantial evidence that Hugh Angleton also introduced both of these friends to Alan Dulles. Both Sindona and Montini allegedly became sources for the CIA after the war, with Hugh's son, James Jesus Angleton, as their case handler. Several historians agree with our sources on this point, although, as we shall see, the Vatican has gone to considerable lengths to deny the allegations. One of James Jesus Angleton's enemies, of whom he had many, insists that his father served as a minor point of contact and occasional courier for secret financial transactions between the Vatican and Nazi Germany. That the Vatican encouraged such investments and even donated money to Hitler himself cannot be denied. A German nun, Sister Pascalina, was present at the creation. In the early 1920s, she was the housekeeper for the Archbishop of the Vatican Nazi connection, Eugenio Pacelli, then the Papal Nuncio in Munich. Sister Pascalina vividly recalls receiving Adolf Hitler late one night and watching the Archbishop give Hitler a large amount of money. Sister Pascalina had absolutely no motive to discredit Archbishop Pacelli. She was his greatest admirer and remained his faithful servant all her life, even after he became Pope Pius XII. Her story has the ring of truth, all the more powerful because it admits the worst blunder of Pacelli's career. It was Pacelli who later convinced the Vatican to invest millions of dollars in the rising German economy, money from the Vatican's land settlement with Mussolini that ended the Pope's claim of sovereignty over territory outside the walls of Vatican City. It was Pacelli who negotiated the Concordat with Hitler's Germany and then had to deal with the consequences of his own mistakes when he became Pope on the eve of World War II. So again, note that the Vatican Bank had invested a great deal of money in Nazi Germany, and it was then Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli who first began channeling Vatican money to the Nazis. He eventually was succeeded by Giovanni Battista Montini, who had helped to assist the flight of not only Nazi war criminals but Nazi capital after World War II. And in this regard, this milieu was working very closely with Alan Dulles, the advisor for the Nazi investments of the Bush family. Returning once again to the secret war against the Jews, the safe haven here refers to the attempts at interdicting the Nazi flight capital program, which was to birth the Bormann organization and the Underground Reich, about which I've spoken so often. Soon after the safe haven inquiry into his own Nazi money smuggling was buried, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS, parenthetically America's World War II intelligence service, and returned to New York to do what he did best, move money illegally for his clients. One of the first names on his client list was a personal matter for Thomas McKittrick, the head of the previously Nazi-dominated Bank of International Settlements, or BIS, in Switzerland. The BIS had overseen the transfer of Nazi assets to Switzerland. After the war, the Nazis moved the money via the Vatican to Argentina. Dulles represented a staggering array of Argentine corporate and political entities before and after the war. President Juan Perón and his family were ardent Catholics and violently anti-communist, as were many Argentines. In fact, Perón was decidedly pro-fascist, and Argentina was the only South American country that continued relations with the Third Reich well into the war. The Argentine economy boomed with the massive post-war transfer of Nazi flight capital. Skipping down. The old spies say that Dulles did not have to try very hard to convince Donovan that President Truman was an idiot and that the only hope of the revival of an American intelligence service was to end the Democratic Party's stranglehold on the White House in the 1948 election. In the meantime, Dulles and Donovan agreed that every effort must be made to sabotage the Truman liberals and quietly prepare for the Cold War. To this end, Dulles convinced Donovan to serve on the board of a company that would help rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against communism. Dulles assured his old boss that there were a large number of wealthy South American investors, especially in Argentina, who were willing to help rebuild Germany. Although Donovan did not know it, Dulles had conned him into serving as the front man for the Nazi money launderers. He and Sir William Stevenson from British Intelligence joined the board of directors of the World Commerce Corporation, with Alan Dulles naturally as their lawyer. The Nazi money flowed in a great circle, out of the Third Reich, through the Vatican, to Argentina, and back to, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany. The source of the miraculous West German economic revival in the 1950s was the same money that had been stolen in the 1940s. One of our sources, Daniel Harkin, stumbled across part of the money laundering in 1945. Harkin had volunteered to work as a double agent for naval intelligence before World War II. He posed as a Nazi ringleader in Detroit and even had his picture published in a newspaper giving the Nazi salute. He was promptly invited to Berlin to meet the leading members of Hitler's cabinet. Hitler didn't know it, but Harkin's work helped close down the Nazi Bund operation in the United States. After wartime service as a naval officer, Harkins was posted to the Allied occupation government in Germany. Although he was genuinely anti-Nazi, Harkins loved and respected the German people who had to survive in the ashes of the bombed-out Third Reich. To Harkins' horror, his German sources revealed that the big Nazis had gotten their money out before the war was over. Through Switzerland, the SS had purchased stock in American corporations and laundered their money through the unknowing Chase and the Korn Exchange Bank. Parenthetically, your veteran listeners will, of course, recognize the Bormann Organization as the organization that grew out of this Nazi money smuggling. A couple of the major elements of its power in contemporary America are not only the huge blocks of stock it holds in American corporations, but also the German core corporation's ability to influence policy through the allocation of advertising money and the media. Those are two major sources of power. Continuing. Even worse, the W.R. Grace Corporation was using its Pan Am Clippers to fly Nazi gems, currency, and bonds to South America. Harkins had discovered a small part of the Dulles money laundering machine conducted in combination with the Vatican. Before he could find out any more, however, he was suddenly transferred to the State Department where the Dulles clique could keep an eye on him. To his surprise, he was then reassigned to the outposts of Southeast Asia. More about this connection. By the way, in the World Commerce Corporation, the front that was used to move this money, in addition to William Donovan and Sir William Stevenson and Alan Dulles, there was also a guy named Edward Stettinius, who was a key partner in the Morgan Financial and Industrial Nexus. We're going to turn now, for more about this discussion, to yet another book by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, the preceding volume to The Secret War Against the Jews. This is called Unholy Trinity, The Vatican, the Nazis, and the Swiss Banks. And in that we read, State Department records for South America confirmed that the Croatian Ustashi Minister for Finance and the French Undersecretary of State for the Vichy government went to Argentina via the Vatican rat line. By the way, that was a conduit to help Nazi collaborators and fascist war criminals escape from Europe to Latin America. Continuing, according to Paul Manning, there were rumors of others. He cites the FBI's copy of a surveillance file forwarded by the Central de Inteligencia of Argentina's Ministry of the Interior. In 1948, Martin Bormann received the bulk of the treasure that had made up the financial reserve of the Deutsche Bank. Like other fugitives, he entered Argentina in 1948, coming from Genoa on a second-class ticket with forged Vatican documentation. Skipping down. In 1945, the U.S. Treasury Department accused Alan Dulles of laundering funds from the Nazi Bank of Hungary into Switzerland. Similar charges were made against Dulles' agent, Hans Bernd Casibius, who had worked for Dulles as an OSS agent while serving at the Reichsbank. By the way, parenthetically, Casibius was also a Gestapo agent, and as we saw in For the Record 445, a collaborator in the post-war period with, among others, Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather of the current seated president of the United States. Continuing. The State Department quickly took over the Treasury Department's money laundering allegations, and the Dulles-Casibius investigation was quietly dropped. Casibius may have had some involvement with the rat lines. He was a senior member of the Black Orchestra during World War II and was considered to be Alan Dulles' pipeline to Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, the Nazi chief of military intelligence. After the war, Casibius personally briefed the Australian government on American efforts to resettle the surplus population of Europe and other countries, citing the support of the Committee for a Free Europe, later acknowledged as a clandestine front for Dulles' Cold War programs. This was also the organization which served as the American end of the Vatican rat lines. The most important front group was an entity called the World Commerce Corporation, established after World War II to rebuild German-South American trade networks. The directors of this corporation were Sir William Stevenson, formerly of British Intelligence, and General William Donovan, formerly of the OSS. One of the attorneys for World Commerce was Alan Dulles, whose assistant, Frank Wisner, was the State Department's deputy for currency and economic reform in the American zone of West Germany. Many of the staff members for the economic reconstruction of occupied Germany came from the same international financial firms which had invested heavily in the pre-war German economy. By the way, Edward Stettinius, as I mentioned, was a Morgan partner, while Bill Donovan, head of the OSS, was also very close to the Morgan Group. Continuing, according to sworn testimony before the U.S. Senate by a representative of the German banking industry, an organization did exist in 1950 which was formed by Lord Shawcross of England and Mr. Hermann Abs of Germany to bring about a Magna Carta for the protection of foreign investments of World War II. This is the same Lord Shawcross who led the recent campaign in the British House of Lords to prevent reopening of war crimes investigations in Britain. Despite allegations by Paul Manning, it's difficult to believe that Shawcross would have lent his good name to Abs organization if he had known its real purpose. In a 1966 hearing before the Select Committee on Standards and Conduct of the U.S. Senate, Abs was identified as the common denominator of a group seeking return of vested enemy properties of World War II. When the United States entered the war in 1941, all of the branches of American banks in France under German control were closed except two which had ties to Abs, Morgan AC and Chase of New York. Both received this special treatment through the intercession of Dr. Hermann Josef Abs of Deutsche Bank, financial advisor to the German government. According to U.S. Treasury agent reports, the favorable treatment was due to an old-school tie, an unspoken understanding among international bankers that wars may come and may go, but the flux of wealth goes on forever. According to Nuremberg records, Abs Deutsche Bank was the principal conduit for laundering Nazi money into Argentina during the war under the supervision of Martin Bormann. The American war crimes investigation of Abs, former head of the Deutsche Bank, was quietly dropped, and Abs was appointed economic advisor for the British zone of Germany. It should also be noted that Abs became a financial advisor to the Vatican. Parenthetically, as we noted in RFAs 17-21, after the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano and the exposure of the Vatican banking scandals, Pope John Paul II brought in Hermann Abs to help straighten out the Vatican mess. And again, theoretically, Pope John Paul II was supposed to have been a slave laborer at Auschwitz. It was Hermann Abs who helped to capitalize the work camps at Auschwitz, and which shed serious doubt that Pope John Paul II was a slave laborer, would suggest rather that he was a privileged minor functionary. Continuing. According to Penny Lernoux, the financial collapse of Vatican-supported banks during the 1970s involved the same group of people connected to Dulles's and Angleton's network of money launderers. Prior to World War II, Angleton's father had financial interests in Milan and may have met both Montini and a Sicilian banker named Michele Sindona at this earlier time. According to Lernoux, Sindona wangled an introduction to the powerful Giovanni Montini in Milan, who would later become Pope Paul VI. Montini introduced Sindona to the leader of the Christian Democrats. Sindona served the younger Angleton for many years as a CIA funnel for supporting funds, unquote, to friendly Italian politicians. In 1969, Sindona became the financial advisor to the Vatican while Montini was the Pope. Sindona and his cohort Roberto Calvi created a financial scandal that cost the Vatican Bank hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, this is what Pope John Paul I was working to clean up. And as we looked at in RFA Program 18, available from Spitfire, the evidence suggests very strongly that JP1 was murdered, and that somebody who could be trusted to keep the secrets, so to keep the lid on this boiling pot of banking scandal, John Paul II, nay Carol Whitelaw, was brought in to straighten out the mess. That again from For the Record 504. Now, we're going to take a look at a key element in the rise of Cardinal Ratzinger through the Vatican. This from the New York Times of April 8, 2005. German Cardinal has a major voice at the funeral, co-authored by Daniel J. Wakin and Mark Landler. Skipping down, we read, speaking of Ratzinger, Pope Paul VI appointed him Bishop of Munich in 1977 and elevated him to Cardinal in just 3 months. He met Carol Wojtyla at a bishop's synod that year. 1977 was as Pope John Paul VI was in failing health, and it was clear that a new pope was going to be elevated. And at this point, we see Ratzinger being appointed first Bishop of Munich, 3 months later made a cardinal. And in that same time period, he meets Carol Wojtyla, who appears to have succeeded as a result of the murder of his predecessor, who was going to clean out the whole P2 Sindona Calvi axis out of the Vatican, that axis having been formed in considerable measure by Giovanni Battista Montini, later Pope Paul VI. And the day that Ratzinger was elected, the following story broke in the LA Times. Other papers reported it earlier. LA Times, April 19, 2005, four charged in 1982 death of banker. Four people were ordered to stand trial in the death of an Italian financier with close ties to the Vatican who was found 23 years ago hanging under London's Blackfriar Bridge. Roberto Calvi had been president of Banco Ambrosiano. He was found with a falsified passport and thousands of dollars in various currencies. Indicted were businessman Flavio Carboni, his ex-girlfriend Manuela Kleinzig, a man with alleged ties to the mafia, Giuseppe Pippo Calo, and businessman Ernesto Giotalevi. And so once again, the same thing that was on the front burner when Pope Paul VI was in failing health and appointing Ratzinger to be Archbishop of Munich and then Cardinal 3 months later, basically is now once again on the front burner. By the way, Michele Sindona said before his death that the failure of the Banco Ambrosiano was because monies had been basically channeled to Latin America for anti-communist activities. And in RFA 18, we also saw how some of the monies that disappeared from the Vatican Bank and related institutions were used to support Solidarity. So the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano and the murder of Roberto Calvi linked with Cold War clandestine operations. We're going to continue with this analysis in Side 2 of this program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 508, The Vatican Rag, Part 2, Der Panzerkardinal, being recorded on April 24th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.